Dr. Brown's dog for you fall.
So they must be put on a sloping thing, and then the typographers will come. And I had access to an empty flat where a teacher was on leave and had given permission for her flat to be used for a good purpose without being instructed in detail what it was. I mean, for the resistance movements, for some. So we put it there and arranged, but there were some conditions to it. I was the only one to know about where the flat was and have the key to that. I was the only one to know where the printing took place and where the printer's address was. And it should happen at night, because he had one or two employees and they mustn't know anything about it. But it was not unusual for him to do his own work of a different kind, whatever he did at night. But of course it must be cleared up in the morning. So I got hold of the typesetters. They came and I had the manuscript in front of me. They set up the pages. And I had a suitcase and one page at a time. There were four pages altogether, but they weigh the hell of a lot. So I had to, and then I put them in my suitcase and put on top of them a pair of trousers. So if it opened, you saw the trousers and nothing else. And then I should, on my bicycle, transport these things to the printer's address in the other end of the town. And then back again, the next page, and then back again, four times. And then I should help him with clearing up and so on later on, because nobody else must know about it. That was his condition. It was fair enough, because it was a big risk for him to take. And then, again, the finished material, the copies, I should transport to a little tailor's place where a group of students were ready, and to pack them. And I had given them a list in advance so that they knew so and so many copies for that town, so and so many for that. So they did all that job. But I couldn't give them the addresses to be sent. I had to write that, because that was in my head and nowhere else, not written down. So when they said Horsens, I said, good. And then I wrote an address, which was usually a false address, not of any of the leaders of the group there, but of somebody who had volunteered to act as address for receiving these things and then informing them. It's now the material has arrived. And then it was sent by bus and by train and by various means and came out. And this was this took some time, but we did it for a while and it was very successful. And I'll show you later on copies of the whole thing, so you can see it. We ended up by printing all together over the whole country every month, something like 160,000 copies of Frit Danmark, which was, I mean, and then you must take into account that each copy had on top of it copy and send to others. And even without that, it was read by many people. It was not sort of like a newspaper being read once and thrown away. People may well have thrown it away because they were scared of keeping it. But many people kept it inside books and so on. And it certainly circulated widely. So it was an important factor in the war of information. But my job was, and my group's job was, to concentrate on this kind of activity to begin with, not to be involved in sabotage. It was strictly, they were strictly told that the danger was people who wanted to do everything. And then because they were caught up involved in one thing, then all the others broke down at the same time. So I had to, in some cases, say to people, you must choose now. You are in the sabotage, all right, stay there, but or in this information, underground information. But you can't be both. Because it's too dangerous getting mixed up. I must say, in the end, I think that, well, I had contact, of course, with the groups also in the way that I could send, we could write code letters to each other. They had an address for me, every group, and also Copenhagen, the central leadership, had addresses me. For me, it was sometimes I had contact with an office and where the leader of the office said, if you come and collect here every now and then letters, which are sent to us, but marked with a special code or something up in a corner, then we won't open them, and I'll give them to you. That was one case, and that worked well for a time until the director of this office was arrested by the Gestapo, and they tried to bargain with him if he would. They would set him free if he would contact me, so that then he would be allowed to go to Sweden and they could arrest me. But he said that I can't do that because it's all, I don't know his address, and he came to me always. I mean, he wasn't willing to, but he didn't have the possibility. There were various ways. Then we had a post box also, but then the Germans knew about it. We were warned by the post office that if we put the key in, there would be somebody sitting in behind, and then we'd be arrested immediately. But we were warned so that nothing happened. And then I had an arrangement with a postmaster, again, of some kind, that he would sort letters in a marked in a certain way, and then in the window he would put a sign if the access was free or not, if there were German there, so that one didn't get in. But anyway, it worked, and nothing happened. I can then tell you a little incident which happened in the summer of, in the summer of 1945. fall, a message came through one of the groups in Aarhus to me, which had passed of various instances, and it was a written message to Mr. Sander. It was from a woman called Grete Bartram. She said she had, I didn't know her, I didn't know her name, but I mean she had obviously contact or was a member of one of the groups and had wanted and had sent it up from one group to another group until it eventually reached me. And she wanted to see me. And I was careful and cautious, and I said, I don't want to see anybody I don't know, and I see already too many people, but if the message is important, you can send it the same way in an enclosed envelope, and then I get it. And then I heard no more about it. But it worried me, and I began to ask some other people about her. And it turned out that she was a communist. Her husband had been arrested, taken by the Germans, and she had volunteered to take his place in the resistance movement. And therefore she was, so to speak, free from suspicion. One couldn't possibly suspect somebody of that kind whose husband had been arrested and so on. But all the same, I said, we must be certain about her because there were rumors that she had been involved in various activities, and on several occasions the whole group, this was also sabotage something, had been arrested, but she had escaped as the only one. And that sounded a little fishy. So I decided we must really make some examinations, find out about her.
What was her name? Grete?
Grete Bartram. B-A-R-T-R-A-M. Grete Bartram. She was young. I've never met her. She was young. And I'm told very sexy girl, 18 years old or something. I had arranged with us, we had one man who followed her. She went into a restaurant and left her cotton coat hanging there. He searched the pockets and found in the pockets notes saying, the name is such as, he calls himself, his false name is such as, he wears glasses, he has moustache, and a description, which was very suspicious, because it could only be meant for one purpose. But it was not enough to state that she was a spy. The other one who followed her to her, the place where she spent the night, and that was with a Gestapo man. And then it was clear she was officially in the service, and I saw my good luck in not having accepted her invitation to meet her. And she was responsible for the arrest and of about 60 people. Many of them died in concentration camps. Many of them became invalids. And she was simply a paid Gestapo agent. So we decided that she must be liquidated. There was no choice here. you must remember the situation. There was no police in Denmark. The police had been sent to Germany, arrested, and sent to German concentration camps. There were no courts. And if she went on, she could be responsible for many more people's death. So we issued orders that she should be shot, but she realized she was in danger and escaped to Copenhagen and tried to get involved with the Communist Party in Copenhagen. But we had sent warnings, or they had sent warnings to them already, so that she didn't manage to infiltrate the Communist Party in Copenhagen. And in the end, of course, she did the only sensible thing. She asked the Germans to arrest her. And she was then sent to a female camp in the south of Jutland, where a number of Danish resistance people were interned. But we managed to smuggle into the camp a warning. Look out, Grete Bartram is a Gestapo agent. So she was completely isolated there as soon as she came in. But of course, when the, now I'm moving forward to when the liberation came, she was arrested. She admitted everything quite openly, but she said, "You're not going to execute me because I'm pregnant with a Gestapo man, and you're not going to execute a pregnant woman." And she was right. She was sentenced first at minor court, and then higher court, and then at the Supreme Court. All three instances to death. But of course, the sentence was never executed and was transformed to prison for life. And life in her case meant 4 years. And then she was sent to Germany. Or she was released and went to Germany, where she had friends. So that's her story.
Was her husband a genuine resistance man?
He was a genuine resistance man. And he had, at one time, I mean, they had separated at one time, and he had warned some people, I don't trust Grady, he says. I think Grady is involved in something. I don't know really, but I would be careful. But they had, the person who heard that hadn't believed him, and therefore it had gone on. So she was, I think she is the most dangerous Gestapo agent who managed to infiltrate in Denmark altogether during the war. And of course, I thanked myself for having, without having any suspicion that time, refused to meet her. Because if I'd met her, my fate. I mean, that was what happened in a lot of cases. She wanted just to meet somebody, and then, of course, she met at a place where Gestapo watched from a window, and then the person was arrested.
So you weren't suspicious of her, but you were just being routinely cautious.
Yes. That's it. Well,
could I just ask you about the Free Denmark publication, paper?
Mm.
Was it identical in all those copies, or was there any local content which varied from place to place?
Yes, there were local editions with local news added to it. I mean, the idea was if there were many published by the, say, the Aarhus or the Horsens Free Denmark Group, but then they had their own name. But the main thing was identical in contents all over. I mean, nobody must change that. They could add a paper of their own, which only circulated in the vicinity, in the town, and was issued by the Free Denmark Group. And that happened often. But the main thing was, the main paper was identical. Not in form, because some of them were duplicated, some were that high. And I'll show you afterwards. You can see I have a complete set of Free Denmark.
Different sizes?
Yeah, different sizes, yes.
And different names?
No, it was Free Denmark. Free Denmark. All the way around. I can tell you, there were various situations where the Germans, I mean, this was after the 29th of August, 1403. Of course, the situation was completely different. We had no Danish authority, we had no Danish government, and soon also the police were removed, and the Jews had been, most of them, saved, as you know, the action of saving the Danish Jews. But there were no authorities, really, in Denmark anymore. The only authority which was universally respected was the Freedom Council. Their statements were really, they were the underground government of Denmark at that time, but a government of a different kind whose names were not known and whose official decrees could only be published, not by radio, but by underground means. But there had been demonstrations whenever the Germans had committed special acts of cruelty. For instance, when 10, 12 Danish students had been arrested and were to be transported from the prison in Copenhagen to Germany. And then when they came outside Copenhagen and near Roskilde, they wanted to urinate. And they said, oh yes, we stop here, you can go out and urinate. And while they urinated, they were shut down from behind all of them. And that was the sort of thing which became quickly known and created a reaction. And there was also a transport of Germans in September 1944, where a number of people were transported, taken and transported to a concentration camp in Germany. And there had been local strikes in Sjælland and in Fyn. But first, but not until in September 1944, did the first national strike go through. And at that time, I was traveling through the whole of my part of Denmark and had very important message, because now the time was approaching when Free Denmark groups and other resistance groups, all coming under the auspices of the Freedom Council, should get to know each other and establish military groups for the eventuality of a war of liberation, which of course didn't happen, but one couldn't know that. And therefore I had arranged in advance, sent out code letters to all addresses in my part of the country, and informed that I was coming, and I had looked carefully in the list of buses and trains and so on. I knew exactly when I would come there, and I could do one place in the afternoon and one place in the evening. And the whole thing was arranged according to a firm schedule. Then I came to a place called Struer, and that was when the group were very eager to send out material in asking people to go on a national strike because of one of the atrocities committed by the Nazis. And this was very effectual. And the result was that the next day all means of transport broke down. And I sat there in on the west coast, but northern west coast, and I was the next scheduled to be in a place called Ringkøbing, which was a long way away, and I had planned to go there by bus, local bus, and of course the buses didn't work, and the trains didn't go, and the telephones didn't work. So it was really a general strike. And I sat discussing this with the local group there. There was a bank manager, and there was a parson, and there was a doctor, and there were various others. And we discussed it. And the doctor said, well, I can arrange an ambulance to send Sander down to this place. So I can tie him up so that he looks really like a damaged person. So I said, no, I don't want that, because that's been used far too often. And what they do is they take the bandage off and find out there's nothing underneath, and then you're worse off. And he agreed that this had been done before and had been found to be untrue. But then the bank manager said, I know a man who has a farmer who does a little extra job by sort of using his car to as a private unorganized taxi driver, and I could contact him, see if I can persuade him to take you to Ringkøbing. First he refused to do it, but then we present him with a story that my sister was dying in a hospital in Ringkøbing, and it was awful if I couldn't come and see her. And that softened him up, and he said, all right, I'll go. So I drove with this man through down through the most empty